It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. In our show today, transformation. Stories and ideas about becoming a completely different person. Imagine rejecting everything you know, everything you were taught to believe, and starting over.
When you think about your life and the arc of your life, do you think of it as a transformation, that you gave yourself a second chance to have a completely different life?
Well, that's a very difficult question.
This is Zach Ibrahim.
I guess I would use the term transformation in some way. I'm very different in my beliefs than I was when I was, even 10 years ago.
And really, you could say his transformation began more than 20 years ago, one November night in 1990. Zach Ibrahim told that story on the TED stage.
On November 5th, 1990, a man named Al-Sayed Nosair walked into a hotel in Manhattan and assassinated Rabbi Meir Kahana, the leader of the Jewish Defense League. Nosair was initially found not guilty of the murder, but while serving time on lesser charges, he and other men began planning attacks on a dozen New York City landmarks, including tunnels, synagogues, and United Nations headquarters. Thankfully, those plans were foiled by an FBI informant. Sadly, the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center was not. Nosair would eventually be convicted for his involvement in the plot. Al-Sayed Nosair is my father.
Zach Ibrahim was just 7 years old at the time. He was too young to know that his dad was a member of a jihadist cell. And eventually, he'd get life in prison. I know you were really young, but I mean, do you remember asking, "Where's Dad?"
I did. I was told that he had been injured and that he was in the hospital, recuperating. And the next thing I know, we are riding in our station wagon to Rikers Island to visit him for the first time. You know, my mother told me, get in the car, we're going to see your father, so I did. You know, the prison guards told me to open my mouth to check inside to see if I was hiding any, you know, razors or something. I just, you know, just kind of went with it.
And Zach basically accepted what a lot of his dad's friends told him, that his father was a hero.
I had one man who, every time he saw me, he would give me a $100 bill. Apparently for what my father had done. I actually bought my first Game Boy with $100 bill that this guy had given me.
Today, 25 years later, Zach Ibrahim is a peace activist. But to get there would require a kind of rebirth.
It was a very slow process. It took a long time, but I had to kind of reevaluate the way I saw my father and his belief system. And so I had to basically realize that my father was an extremist and that he was willing to take innocent people's lives for his cause.
To realize that, to experience that kind of transformation, meant he had to make a choice to change.
I was born in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania in 1983 to him, an Egyptian engineer, and a loving American mother and grade school teacher who together tried their best to create a happy childhood for me. It wasn't until I was 7 years old that our family dynamics started to change. My father exposed me to a side of Islam that few people, including the majority of Muslims, get to see. A few months prior to his arrest, he sat me down and explained that for the past few weekends, he and some friends had been going to a shooting range on Long Island for target practice. He told me I'd be going with him the next morning. We arrived at Calverton Shooting Range, which, unbeknownst to our group, was being watched by the FBI. When it was my turn to shoot, my father helped me hold the rifle to my shoulder and explained how to aim at the target about 30 yards off. That day, the last bullet I shot hit the small orange light that sat on top of the target, and to everyone's surprise, especially mine, the entire target burst into flames. My uncle turned to the other men and in Arabic said, Ibn Abu, like father, like son. They thought they saw in me the same destruction my father was capable of. Those men would eventually be convicted of placing a van filled with 1,500 pounds of explosives into the sub-level parking lot of the World Trade Center's North Tower, causing an explosion that killed 6 people and injured over 1,000 others. These were the men I looked up to. These were the men I called Ammu, which means uncle. By the time I turned 19, I had already moved 20 times in my life. And that instability during my childhood didn't really provide an opportunity to make many friends. Being the perpetual new face in class, I was frequently the target of bullies. So for the most part, I spent my time at home, reading books and watching TV or playing video games. And growing up in a bigoted household, I wasn't prepared for the real world. I'd been raised to judge people based on arbitrary measurements like a person's race or religion.
He would just talk about Jews being evil, and I would hear similar things from, you know, from the men that were with him, gay people being evil and them wanting to turn you gay so that you would go to hell too, and just them being, you know, all around terrible people and a bad influence. And he used to say things like, a bad Muslim is better than a good non-Muslim.
Do you ever remember, you know, sort of feeling that way too?
That's pretty much what indoctrination is. You know, you have authority figures around you telling you that the world is one way, and you don't get to see another perspective. You know, the people that I felt safe with taught me these things, and so, you know, you just kind of accepted them as fact.
One of my first experiences that challenged this way of thinking was during the 2000 presidential elections. Through a college prep program, I was able to take part in the National Youth Convention in Philadelphia. My particular group's focus was on youth violence, and having been the victim of bullying for most of my life, this was a subject in which I felt particularly passionate. The members of our group came from many different walks of life. One day toward the end of the convention, I found out that one of the kids I had befriended was Jewish. Now, it had taken several days for this detail to come to light, and I realized that there was no natural animosity between the two of us. I had never had a Jewish friend before, and frankly, I felt a sense of pride in having been able to overcome a barrier that for most of my life I had been led to believe was insurmountable. Another major turning point came when I found a summer job at Busch Gardens, an amusement park. As chance would have it, I had the opportunity to work with some of the gay performers at a show there, and soon found that many were the kindest, least judgmental people I had ever met. I don't know what it's like to be gay, but I'm well acquainted with being judged for something that's beyond my control. One day I had a conversation with my mother about how my worldview was starting to change. And she said something to me that I will hold dear to my heart for as long as I live. She looked at me with the weary eyes of someone who'd experienced enough dogmatism to last a lifetime and said, I'm tired of hating people. In that instant, I realized how much negative energy it takes to hold that hatred inside of you.
That must have been so powerful.
That was one of the most transformative times in my life. I kind of just wanted to let her know where my mind was starting to go. And when she told me, it felt like she gave me permission to go out into the world and just experience people for who they were instead of trying to fit them into some kind of, you know, category or box of some kind, just to be free in a way.
You describe what you've done as a choice, that you made a choice. You decided that you were not going to be this person that you were kind of raised to be.
Well, I don't know that we're meant to be anything other than the sum of our experiences. And I knew that from my experience that I had, you know, from being bullied, that I didn't want to be the bully. And at the same time, I didn't want to be bullied because I knew what that felt like, the loneliness and the feelings of inadequacy and self-loathing. I knew that I didn't want to treat people like that. And if I could, I wanted to prevent others from treating people like that so that they didn't have to go through the same thing.
Zach Ibrahim is not my real name. I changed it when my family decided to end our connection with my father and start a new life. So why would I out myself and potentially put myself in danger? Well, that's simple. I do it in the hopes that perhaps someone someday who is compelled to use violence may hear my story and realize that there is a better way. That although I had been subjected to this violent, intolerant ideology, that I did not become fanaticized. Instead, I choose to use my experience to fight back against terrorism, against bigotry. I do it for the victims of terrorism and their loved ones, for the terrible pain and loss that terrorism has forced upon their lives. For the victims of terrorism, I will speak out against these senseless acts and condemn my father's actions. And with that simple fact, I stand here as proof that violence isn't inherent in one's religion or race, and the son does not have to follow the ways of his father. I am not my father. Thank you.
Zach Ibrahim, peace activist. He's the author of the newly released TED book, The Terrorist's Son, A Story of Choice. You can find out more about it and see Zach's full talk at TED.com. More stories of transformation in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, transformation. Stories and ideas about changing everything you are, becoming who you were meant to be. When you, this is a little bit strange, but when you look in the mirror, do you think, God, I'm a beautiful person. I look great.
I think now, because it's my work as a model, yes, I do feel beautiful. But there was moments in my life where I never felt beautiful.
This is Gina Rosero. She's been a fashion model for about a decade. And to describe Gina as beautiful, something of an understatement. She is stunning. High cheekbones, long dark hair, slender. And when she walked onto the TED stage, she stood in front of a huge photo of herself in lingerie. You know, it's just unusual.
I'm auditioning, basically. This is a casting call. Maybe someone wants to hire me.
But of course, you were showing that photograph to tell a bigger story about your journey.
Yeah, it's giving me goosebumps bringing back that memory, because it's one of those moments in your life where you're so conscious about what you're about to do, and what you're about to do will change your life.
Here's Gina's story from the TED stage.
The world makes you something that you're not, but you know inside what you are. And that question burns in your heart. How will you become that? So when I became a fashion model, I felt that I finally achieved the dream that I've always wanted since I was a young child. My outside self finally matched my inner truth. At that time, I felt like, Gina, you've done it. You've made it. You have arrived. But this past October, I realized that I'm only just beginning. In my case, for the last 9 years, some of my neighbors, some of my friends, colleagues, even my agent did not know about my history. I think in mystery, this is called a reveal. Here is mine. I was assigned boy at birth based on the appearance of my genitalia.
This moment when you spoke on the TED stage and you revealed this for the first time publicly, it was just like silent. You could hear a pin drop, and you had revealed this thing that you had kept secret from so many people for so long.
Yeah.
You were born a boy. I mean, do you remember thinking as a kid, I'm not a boy?
Yeah. So growing up, I would always wear this T-shirt in my head or the blanket or the fabric if I want my hair to be long, and I would wear it in my head. And I remember that moment when my mom asked me, how come you always wear that? And I told her, Mom, this is my hair. I'm a girl. Gender has always been considered a fact, immutable. What we now know, it's actually more fluid, complex, and mysterious. Because of my success, I never had the courage to share my story. Not because I thought what I am is wrong, but because how the world treats those of us who wish to break free. Every day, I am so grateful because I am a woman. I have a mom and dad and family who accepted me for who I am. Many are not so fortunate. There's a long tradition in Asian culture that celebrates the fluid mystery of gender. There's a Buddhist goddess of compassion. There is a Hindu goddess, Hidra goddess. So when I was 8 years old, I was at a fiesta in the Philippines celebrating these mysteries. I was in front of this stage, and I remember out comes this beautiful woman right in front of me, and I remember that moment, something hit me. That is the kind of woman I would like to be. So when I was 15 years old, still dressing as a boy, I met this woman named TL. She is a transgender beauty pageant manager. That night, she asked me, how come you are not joining the beauty pageant? She convinced me that if I joined, that she will take care of the registration fee and the garments. And that night, I won best in swimsuit and best in long gown and placed second runner-up amongst 40-plus candidates. That moment changed my life. Not a lot of people could say that your first job is a pageant queen for transgender women, but I'll take it. In 2001, my mom, who had moved to San Francisco, called me and told me that my green card petition came through, that I could now move to the United States. I resisted it. I told my mom, Mom, I'm having fun. I'm here with my friends. I love traveling, being a beauty pageant queen. But then 2 weeks later, she called me. She said, did you know that if you moved to the United States, you could change your name and gender marker? That was all I needed to hear. My mom also told me to put two E's in the spelling of my name. She also came with me when I had my surgery in Thailand at 19 years old. At that time in the United States, you needed to have a surgery before you could change your name and gender marker. So in 2001, I moved to San Francisco. And I remember looking at my California driver's license with the name Gina and gender marker F. That was a powerful moment. I mean, for some people, their ID is their license to drive or even to get a drink. But for me, that was my license to live, to feel dignified. I mean, all of a sudden, my fears were minimized. I felt that I could conquer my dream and move to New York and be a model.
So you move to New York, and then you get discovered, you start modeling. How open were you about your past?
So when I moved to New York, I made a conscious decision to not fully share about my journey into womanhood. And first, I wasn't ready to talk about it. Second, I knew people have this misconception about what it means to be trans. And I just don't want to have that conversation first and foremost. And it wasn't until December last year, 2013, when I told my model agent that I'm a transgender woman.
What did
What did your agent say?
When I made the decision to go public about this,
I'm not just going to go public. I'm going to go on the TED stage and go public.
I remember, okay, that's right. I need to talk to my agent and share with him. I picked up that phone call. I said, Ron, this is what I'm about to do, and this is the story I want to share. And I remember having that pause. And then he said, well, congratulations. I'm proud of you. I am, you know, I'm here. I support you, which is a big sigh of relief. I mean, I remember being, you know, so nervous. So nervous.
I mean, in that time, because you were a model in New York for more than a decade, were you ever afraid that somebody would, I don't know, find out and it would hurt your career?
It's a big yes. I was always in a constant state of paranoia. There's nothing worse than being outed. There's nothing worse than people taking control of your narrative. So I guess subconsciously, I didn't let that fear paralyze me.
What happened to get you to decide to do that? Like, what inspired you to say, you know what, I'm going to tell people about my past?
I think first, I want to free myself. There's a sense of, you know, I just want to be fully open about things. And also at the same time, I want to give back to the transgender community. Today, this very moment is my real coming out. I could no longer live my truth for and by myself. I want to do my best to help others live their truth without shame and terror. My deepest truth allowed me to accept who I am.
When you think about your life, do you think about it as a life transformed, or do you think about it more of almost like a life restored?
I think it's definitely life transformed. And I think I'm still transforming. I think I'm in constant evolution, especially with the support of my family. That allowed me to just be fully who I am, and added with opportunities that was presented to me that I accepted, that I did everything I can to achieve that goal.
Yeah. I mean, I think about your story, and it's almost like you can't, like, control your circumstances, right? You couldn't control who you were born as, but in some ways you can shape your future.
Certainly. If you are conscious, you know, of what is being presented to you, if you have that consciousness of opportunity, of really foreseeing a goal or a dream that you have, just do it.
Gina Rosero, she's the co-founder of the transgender advocacy group Gender Proud. To find out more about Gina and to see her talk, go to ted.npr.org. About 30 years ago, on a cold January day, Hugh Herr and a friend were climbing Mount Washington in New Hampshire. They had made it up a difficult part of the climb when very suddenly, the light snowfall turned into something far more intense.
And, you know, a blizzard conditions set in. We got to the top of this ice face, which is about 800 feet. And we made the mistake of continuing towards the summit of the mountain in ever worsening conditions, blizzard conditions.
Hugh Herr was an expert climber, one of the top climbers in the U.S. He'd been climbing almost since the day he could walk.
By the age of 15, 16, I was climbing 1,000-foot walls, 2,000-foot walls, sometimes without a rope.
Wow.
So yes, it was a life of adventure when I was a kid.
But that day in New Hampshire, even Hugh's considerable experience didn't matter. He and his fellow climber, Jeff Batzer, were now climbing in whiteout conditions.
When we hit tree line, we had realized we had gone off course. But at that point, the blizzard was so intense that it would have been suicidal to retrace our tracks. The average depth of snow was to the waist, sometimes to the chest. It was very difficult to make progress.
Hugh and Jeff were trapped. And for 4 days, they huddled together in makeshift snow caves just to survive.
the frostbite in their legs was so severe, so painful, they didn't think they'd make it.
We were in one of our snow caves. We had given up hope, and we were trying to accelerate the death process because we were in so much pain. And, you know, this person appeared. We first thought we were, you know, seeing things. We first thought this person wasn't real. But she was out snowshoeing for the day and came across footprints, seemed to be human footprints, and followed them to our cave. And we were ultimately rescued by helicopter and taken to Littleton, New Hampshire.
So initially, they thought that they would be able to save your legs, right?
I wouldn't go that far. The doctors were willing to attempt it, but in the beginning, they looked like biological legs that were simply black in some areas and swollen. But eventually, after a month or two, they no longer looked human. And at that point, you know, mentally, psychologically, one, you know, wants to get rid of the legs that really cannot even be labeled as legs anymore.
Hugh Herr's transformation would begin the moment his legs were amputated. At a rehab center, he was fitted with these clunky, uncomfortable prosthetic legs, and his doctor warned him that he'd have a long and hard recovery.
And I said, you know, I want to return to mountain climbing. I want to ride a bicycle. You know, I said a few such things, and he said very quickly that climbing was out of the question. I might be able to ride a bicycle. And he said, I'll be able to drive a car, but through the use of hand controls. So I was devastated by the conversation. Then I realized he had no idea what climbing was, and so he had no real authority to state that I would or would not be able to climb again.
Losing his legs seemed like the ultimate transformation, but the real change in Hugh Herr's life was just beginning. He picks up the story from the TED stage.
I didn't view my body as broken. I reasoned that a human being can never be broken. Technology is broken. Technology is inadequate. This simple but powerful idea was a call to arms to advance technology for the elimination of my own disability and ultimately to the disability of others. I began by developing specialized limbs that allowed me to return to the vertical world of rock and ice climbing. I quickly realized that the artificial part of my body is malleable, able to take on any form, any function, a blank slate for which to create perhaps structures that could extend beyond biological capability. I made my height adjustable. I could be as short as 5 feet or as tall as I'd like. So when I was feeling badly about myself, insecure, I would jack my height up. But when I was feeling confident and suave, I would knock my height down a notch just to give the competition a chance. Narrow wedge feet allow me to climb steep rock fissures where the human foot cannot penetrate. And spiked feet enable me to climb vertical ice walls without ever experiencing muscle leg fatigue. Through technological innovation, I returned to my sport stronger and better. Technology had eliminated my disability and allowed me a new climbing prowess.
And as he returned to competitive climbing using prosthetic legs that he designed himself, Hugh got more and more interested in how to make those legs better.
So I invented this prosthetic foot made of polyethylene blades coated with sticky climbing rubber. And you could put the blade into the crack and rotate the leg and wedge it and then extend the leg and make progress up the mountain. So that was a lot of fun. But people, of course, accused me of cheating. I just said, you're free, completely free to amputate your own legs and achieve the same competitive advantage. But no one took me up on it.
How did you take that leap from being told that you would not be able to do this definitively to telling yourself, I'm going to do this?
Perhaps I'm stubborn. You know, some people view an artificial limb as something that's depressing, the source of disability. I viewed it as a source of adventure, of potential, because I realized that through innovation, through design, that artificial part of my body could be anything I wanted.
So if losing his legs was the first transformation, and then designing his own prosthetic legs was the second, he was about to undergo the third and possibly most profound transformation yet. That story in a moment. I'm Guy Raz, and you're listening to the TED Radio Hour from NPR. It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Guy Raz. And on the show today, transformation, stories and ideas about a life completely changed by choice, or in the case of Hugh Herr, by circumstance. So we were just hearing about how Hugh lost his legs in a rock climbing accident, and before it happened, he wasn't particularly interested in math or science or technology. What he really wanted to be was the best rock climber in the world.
But then after the accident, when I experienced how hideous and pathetic and unsophisticated prosthetic technology was at that time, I became interested in design. I designed my climbing limbs, and I was successful at that endeavor. And it kind of drove me towards studying mathematics and physics and later engineering. And it turns out I loved it. I had an absolute passion for those topics.
So as he worked to improve and perfect his own prosthetics, Hugh decided to pursue mechanical engineering and then later a PhD in biophysics. And he became convinced that he could transform other people, which is what he does today. Hugh leads a team of scientists at MIT working to solve one simple problem.
In the world of design, we have no idea how to attach synthetic structures to our bodies in a healthy, comfortable way. The example of shoes giving us blisters, isn't it extraordinary? Like one of the most mature, oldest devices on the human timeline, the shoe. We
right.
still don't understand yes. how to design the damn thing.
Right.
So every device that attaches to our body, you know, women with bras, braces, prostheses like eyewear can be very, very uncomfortable. You know, right now, if you ask, you know, 100 persons with leg amputation, what's the number one problem you want solved about your artificial limb? Probably all 100 would say, it hurts. You know, please fix that.
So Hugh, he set out to do just that.
What's dropping down?
Oh my God.
The woman on this recording is, for the first time, trying out a pair of bionic legs designed by Hugh Herr and his team at MIT.
Oh my God, I can't believe it!
She can now walk up and down stairs.
It's just like I've got a real leg!
There's no handrail, she's not using a cane, no help from anyone, because inside her legs there are 12 tiny sensors that feed right into microcomputers.
Very small computers. The surface area roughly of a fingernail.
And those computers run algorithms that decide how to tweak tiny motors in each leg, which control
how the limb should move, how it should stiffen, how it should power itself.
Hugh wears a pair himself, and he says these prosthetic legs with power, with moving parts, designed to mimic the force of normal muscles, could transform life for disabled people of all kinds.
Now, turn around and do the same thing walking up. Walk up, get on your heel to toe like you would normally just walk on level ground. Try to walk right up the hill.
Oh, my God.
Is it pushing you up?
Yes, I can't even describe it.
It's pushing you right up.
You guys just don't know what it's like not to have that.
It's amazing because it's almost like this kind of drove you to reimagine who you were, who you are, who you were going to be, and what this disability was going to mean. And it's almost like you kind of turned it into something And something that made you, like, better and stronger.
My new body with biological leg amputations is not necessarily a disability, right? The disability comes in if the technology is inadequate. If the technology is very good, it's simply a condition, but it's not a disability. So that's the world that I envisioned and the world that I'm working towards technologically.
Over half of the world's population suffers from some form of cognitive, emotional, sensory, or motor condition. And because of poor technology, too often conditions result in disability and a poorer quality of life. Basic levels of physiological function should be a part of our human rights. Every person should have the right to live life without disability if they so choose. The right to live life without severe depression. The right to see a loved one in the case of seeing impaired. Or the right to walk or to dance in the case of limb paralysis or limb amputation. As a society, we can achieve these human rights if we accept the proposition that humans are not disabled. A person can never be broken. Our built environment, our technologies, are broken and disabled. We, the people, need not accept our limitations, but can transcend disability through technological innovation. Indeed, through fundamental advances in bionics in this century, we will set the technological foundation for an enhanced human experience, and we will end disability.
What do you think it is that allowed you to like almost regenerate, to kind of accept and then to embrace a transformation that you didn't ask for?
I mean, I think at the core is a thing called creativity. But key to being creative is imagining what hasn't happened yet, imagining what the future can be, and believing in that dream so wholeheartedly that you inspire yourself and the world to actually transfer dreams into physical objects, into technology.
Hugh Herr runs the Center for Extreme Bionics at MIT. To see his talk and the amazing work they do, go to TED.com. Our show today, ideas and stories about transformation, the people who look at their lives and say, I'm going to change this one thing, or maybe everything. When we're talking about your life, right, and this life that you once had, does it feel like in some way that you and I are talking about a different person?
Yeah, because I oftentimes it feels like I'm flashing back and just like wondering what my face looked like back then, wondering did I ever smile, because I don't feel like I smiled back then. Just looking back, it's like, wow, like I can't even believe it sometimes. And I mean, I've had moments where I cried for that young man that I was.
This is Shaka Sengor. He's a writer and a mentor to young people in Detroit, where he grew up. And here's how he began his story at TED.
23 years ago, at the age of 19, I shot and killed a man. I was a young drug dealer with a quick temper and a semi-automatic pistol. But that wasn't the end of my story. In fact, it was the beginning. There's a story of acknowledgement, apology, and atonement. But it didn't happen in the way that you might imagine or think. See, like many of you, growing up, I was an honor roll student with dreams of becoming a doctor. But things went dramatically wrong when my parents separated and eventually divorced.
Shaka explains that when his parents split up, his grades started to fall. His mom was abusive, both mentally and physically. And so a few years later, he started to sell drugs.
At the age of 17, I got shot 3 times standing on the corner of my block in Detroit. My friend rushed me to the hospital. Doctors pulled the bullets out, patched me up, and sent me back to the same neighborhood I got shot. Throughout this ordeal, no one hugged me. No one told me I would be okay. No one told me that I would live in fear, that I would become paranoid. But no one told me that one day I would become the person behind the trigger. 14 months later, I fired the shots that caused the man's death. When I entered prison, I was angry, I was hurt, I didn't want to take responsibility. And I reacted with hostility to my confinement. I ran black market stores, I loaned sharks, and I sold drugs that was illegally smuggled into the prison. I had in fact become what the warden of the Michigan Reformatory called the worst of the worst. And because of my activity, I landed in solitary confinement for 7.5 years out of my incarceration.
I mean, that is so hard to imagine living like that. But I mean, how did you start to go from that place to where you eventually got to where you are now?
You know, it kind of grew in stages. I think the first time was I had read Malcolm X's autobiography, just his ability to redeem himself and turn himself around kind of pricked my consciousness in a way to make me think like this is possible. And so literature kept me strong. Whenever I felt myself growing vulnerable to feeling like I was going to go insane or feeling like I couldn't cope one more day in this little 6x9 cell, I would just turn to literature. I would turn to books. And at some point, I began to set my cell up like a classroom. And I would study a different subject each hour as if I were going to school. And kind of like the tipping point came after I received a letter from my oldest son.
And anytime I would get this letter from my son, it was like a ray of light in the darkest place you can imagine. And on this particular day, I opened this letter, and in capital letters, he wrote, "My mama told me why you was in prison. Murder." He said, "Dad, don't kill. Jesus watches what you do. Pray to him." Now, I wasn't religious at that time, nor am I religious now, but it was something so profound about my son's words. It was the first time in my life that I had actually thought about the fact that my son would see me as a murderer. I sat back on my bunk and I reflected on something I had read in Plato's Republic, where Socrates stated in an apology that the unexamined life isn't worth living. At that point is when the transformation began.
When he wrote that letter, you know, it made me realize that, you know, whatever happened, whether I ever got out of prison or not, that I had a responsibility as a father to give my son an example of what a man should be and what he could be. That's when I began to do the hard work, which was uncovering how did I land in prison in the first place. I just saw it in the most basic, simple way that I would do whatever was necessary to reclaim the parts of me that I knew were good.
When I got that letter from my son, I began to write a journal about things I had experienced in my childhood and in prison. And what it did is it opened up my mind to the idea of atonement. Earlier in my incarceration, I had received a letter from one of the relatives of my victim. And in that letter, she told me she forgave me because she realized I was a young child who had been abused and had been through some hardships and just made a series of poor decisions. It was the first time in my life that I ever felt open to forgiving myself.
Do you ever think about just the capacity that humans have to regenerate, like for self-regeneration and for like almost rebirth?
Yeah.
Do you think it's like an inherent human capability, or do you think that just some people have that ability?
Yes, I do. I think that human beings are so resilient, and I think that we have failed to acknowledge that. We tend to make transformation a freak show, so to speak. as something that's abnormal or in, you know, or not.
Or like superhuman.
Superhuman, right.
Yeah.
And I've never thought of it like that. When it comes to my own personal journey, when you are in prison, it's all about authenticity in that environment. You know, if guys think you are trying to play the good guy to get a parole or to get favor from the officers or something like that, they'll prey on that, you know. But when they know that it's genuine and it's not based on fear, but it's based on you wanting to be who you were destined to be, they respect and they celebrate that. And what I realize is that the majority of men I encounter had the desire for something different, something better. The thing that was lacking was the courage to step out on their own, or for somebody to give them permission to step out on their own. And I think what happened with me is that I learned how to give myself permission.
You mentioned that line from Socrates about the unexamined life not being worth living. It sounds weird, but like, had you not gone through the pain that you went through in your life, you may not have had an examined life.
It's true. You know, had I not gone through this experience, and I see it, you know, I see it in most people's lives. We, you know, the typical trajectory is you get up, you go to work, you pay the bills, you come home, take care of your family, repeat. But I found that life is so much deeper than that. We have to give ourselves permission to expand and grow and evolve as human beings. That's our nature. And it wasn't easy. It didn't come without its challenges. You know, even when I was released from prison, there are constant challenges, constant battles. I didn't come home to a rosy neighborhood. You know, I came back home to Detroit, you know, the city I grew up in, the friends I grew up around, who some are still in the street culture and living, you know, half-butchered lives.
Through my experience being locked up, one of the things I discovered is this. The majority of men and women who are incarcerated are redeemable. Anybody can have transformation if we create the space for that to happen. So what I'm asking today is that you envision a world where men and women aren't held hostage to their past, where misdeeds and mistakes doesn't define you for the rest of your life. I think collectively we can create that reality. And I hope you do too. Thank you.
Shaka Sangor, his talk is at TED.com. After getting out of prison 4 years ago, he's become a mentor to young people in Detroit. He's also engaged to be married, and the son who wrote him that letter in prison, he's now 22 years old. Going on a vision quest, surf the mountain, ride the crest. I've been looking in a new direction. The sun is out, I'm getting scorched. The world is weird from my front porch. I've been looking in a new direction. I wanna laugh and I wanna cry. I wanna spit but my mouth's too dry. I wanna run but I'm scared that my legs won't go. Where did they go? Thanks for listening to our show this week, Transformation. If you missed any of it or you want to find out more about who was on it, check out ted.npr.org. You can also find many, many more TED Talks at ted.com. You can download this show through iTunes or through the NPR smartphone app. If you like the show or hate it or hate us or maybe even love us, please let us know. Go to ted.npr.org, click on Contact. Our Twitter handle is @TED Radio Hour. I'm Guy Raz, and you've been listening to Ideas Worth Spreading on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.